Dr. Lynn body.
Did it fall or was it pushed? Is fungal decay an inside job? Well, I guess that's a title which could have many talks associated with it, and I rather like the title, so I expect I shall use it again and again for different talks. But obviously, I think you probably have gathered from what Alan said already that the question relates to this problem of cause and consequence. Now, what I'm actually going to talk about is two specific... Could you focus it from there? Thank you. It's two specific topics which Alan has introduced already. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the origin of decay, or at least the origin of some types of decay, about latency, which will be revealed in a moment, and again, something which Alan's already introduced to you. I want to talk about water as the major controlling factor of development of decay in trees. So my talk is going to be much more specific than Alan's. I think it might be a good idea to start to think about how we could look at fungal communities and decay in trees. And I suppose probably all of us would start this by looking at fruit bodies on the outside of wood. This next set of slides are all of oak, and you've seen this fungus already in one of Alan's slides. It's Peniophora quercina fruiting here. Rather more dried-up version than Alan showed you. Volaminia comedens fruit in here. And we can be forgiven, I think, for missing some of these things because it does look rather as if it's just bark peeled back, but it is indeed Volaminia comedens. And then things like witch's butter, Exidia glandulosa on this suppressed oak stem. Same thing again in a rather dehydrated state here. And, of course, this is a common feature with canopy fungi. They do dehydrate very commonly, but they leap into life again as soon as they get wet. And this time we've got Phalaenus ferreus. Right. The thing is, these are fruit bodies of fungi, and as Alan has already pointed out, it's the mycelium which is the most significant part of the fungus. We want to know about where the mycelium is, what it's doing, all about the decay it's producing, not just about the fruit bodies. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about how we might go about doing this before we go much further. Now, what we've done very commonly is to chop down a branch, indicated here, and then what you can do is to section it. So typically we might take some sections from here and then from here, all along the length of the branch. Very often we've taken three sections at any one point and done different things to these. One of the sections we might estimate the density because this gives us a good indication of the state of decay. Another section we could record the patterns within, and you've already seen the types of patterns which you can get in wood. And we could put this in a poly bag, spray it with water, and eventually we would see mycelium growing out. We would see where the fungus is from the position of the mycelium. So this would give us some clues. And then, of course, we could identify these mycelia so we would know what species were present. With the third section, again, we'd like to record the patterns. And this time, we commonly make isolations from the different regions. So we take out chips of wood and put them onto the agar jelly plates, which Alan showed you earlier. And again, the mycelium will grow out into pure culture. Again, we should be able to identify what fungi are present. I said very glibly that we can identify what fungi are present. It's not necessarily that easy because, as I'm sure you're aware, we usually identify fungi via the fruit bodies using keys, and unfortunately there are very few keys for mycelium. But with a reasonable amount of practice and some serendipity, I guess, we can usually make identifications of mycelium as well. So we now know what fungi we've got in the different regions of the branch, but there are still other things which we can do. We can pair up the isolates. Again, you've seen this already introduced to you by Alan. We can pair them up on agar. We can pair up different species to see which fungi win in confrontations. And we can pair up isolates of the same species to determine whether we have the same or different genotype. Let me take you through some of these things in a little bit more detail now. This is a section through an oak branch I suppose, 7 or 8 centimetres in diameter. And you can see these different regions which I've just mentioned. These are the interaction zone lines which demarcate different fungi. So you've got one fungus in there, another one here, something else in there. These are not interaction zone lines here. It's what Alan again has already mentioned. Heartwood wings. This time we don't have any heartwood yet developed in the centre of the branch because it's not large enough, but the wings have nonetheless developed. I personally think that heartwood wings result following cambial death, which is not necessarily due to the presence of a fungus. It's to do with aeration and all sorts of other things. So we've got these different regions from which we've made our isolations. This is the next section along the branch, and you can see this is one which I've direct incubated, put it in a polythene bag, sprayed with water, and mycelium has grown out. This is mycelium of Voluminia comedens, as it happens in this instance. This is Peniophora quercina. You can just about still make out the heartwood wings. This part of the branch was still functional at the time of chopping down. You can see no mycelium has grown out of it. This little patch here has grown from off of there. I mentioned that you can make pairings on agar to determine whether we've got the same genotype, the same individual, just to emphasise this again. These three inocular plugs came from the same original culture, so they obviously have, they're obviously from the same individual. The mycelia have grown out and they've met there and there, and they fuse and they now behave as one. On the other hand, this is a different individual here, and you can see when its mycelium encountered that of the other one, you can see there were recognition reactions, and you can see clearly that it is not, has not joined up with the other mycelia. It is not behaving as one. So clearly we can recognise different individual fungi in the same way as we are all individuals in this room. And we can make use of this tool, make pairings from our isolates from wood, and determine where in the wood we have individuals and where we have lots, where we have a few, etc., etc. Okay, so we now know the sorts of techniques we have. What can we do with them? How can we make pictures of what is going on in branches? Well, this is the sort of thing that you can obtain. This is a large oak branch. The trunk would have been there. You can see the scale here. This represents 1 metre. And each of these sections have got interaction lines in them, here, here. Each of these different coloured regions obviously were not the colour of the wood. I got carried away with my felted pens, but what I've done is to colour in regions which are the same individual. The sections through the oak branch you saw earlier actually came from somewhere around here. So we happen to have 2 individuals of Voluminia comedens and 6 or so of Peniophora quercina, 1 unidentified. I said we could usually identify mycelia. I lied. But so 6 Peniophoras, 2 Voluminias. Let's just look at one of the Voluminias. Here we go. A brown one there, extending, I suppose, 4 or 5 metres. Again, we've got the functional sapwood, remember, surrounded by the heartwood wings. But this is very important, then. We get these very long individuals. This is in oak. We get long individuals in other things also. This happens to be the same sort of thing in an ash branch. D indicates Daldinia concentrica, King Alfred's cakes we've already heard about. H is Hypoxylon rubiginosum. And again, you can see we have the same sort of scale as before. Large individuals of Daldinia. Large individuals of Hypoxylon rubiginosum. Same sort of thing in hazel. Sometimes large individuals in beech. Same sort of things in lots of angiosperm trees. But it's not just the extent of the individuals which is important. It's the fact they seem to develop very, very quickly. And this particular, the individuals in this particular, focus has gone wonky. I've broken it probably. The individuals in this particular branch developed in less than one growing season. We know this because we can count the annual rings in the functional region, we can count the annual rings in the decayed region, and they're the same. So these huge individuals developed in a very short time. Now, if I tell you that we've done experiments in the lab where we've grown these things under a range of conditions, we've worked out the optimal conditions for growth, what we find is that even if one of these individuals got in halfway along the length of the column, it's very unlikely that they could extend as mycelia over that distance in such a short time. Under optimum conditions in the lab, maybe they could just about do it. In the field, where conditions are usually far from optimal, it seems highly unlikely. So this led us to wonder, how is it that these things become established? It doesn't look as if they get in through major wounds. It doesn't look as if they get in through major wounds, and indeed, if we actually inoculate these fungi on inoculum plugs, you've seen a similar photograph of this already, they can only extend rather short distances. This is about 8 centimetres. That's 1 centimetre long, that inoculum plug. So even if we inoculate them, they don't seem to grow very far. It doesn't look as if they get in through major wounds and extend as mycelia. So how do they form these very long columns? Well, I dare say there are quite a few things one could suggest, but the thing we plumped for was that perhaps they are already present in the wood, in healthy, functional sapwood. Now, you could explain these patterns if, in a healthy, functional branch, there are propagules dispersed throughout the columns of wood. They can't develop for most of the time because, again, as indicated earlier, most basidiomycete fungi do not cope well with high water contents. They need aeration. So they don't cope well under conditions of high water content. And of course, as you know, sapwood is full with water. That's the whole function of sapwood, is to conduct water. So this high water content then could prevent propagules from developing as mycelia. However, if we remove this stress, if we remove the high water content, for example, maybe it's root death or drought or something like that, but whatever the means, if we remove the high water content, you could envisage that these propagules might then develop as mycelia. And if they were of the same genotype, when they meet, if they're distributed well along this branch, lots of propagules, they grow as mycelia. Once the high water content has been removed, when they meet, they would fuse and intermingle and become as one in the way we've already described on the agar plates. That would explain those patterns. Well, this is all very well. It's a very nice hypothesis, but one obviously has to go a little further than this and test the hypothesis. So that just summarises what I've already said to you. Let's think how we might test this hypothesis. Well, what we could do is actually alter water relations ourselves. Let's not wait for a drought or root death. Let's alter the water relations and see if these propagules develop. So what we did was to go along to trees, chop down lots of perfectly functional, healthy branches, chop them into lots of different sections along the length, and then incubate them under different drying regimes. What we might hope would happen is that fungi would then develop in that wood, and we could isolate them onto agar plates. We could make isolations from each of the sections, and we could pair them up to see if we were getting, effectively, these long genotypes. Now, whilst the earlier work I've described has been done on oak, when it came to the time to test this hypothesis, I happened to have a student who was working on beech. So we obviously then turned our attention to beech. And, as I say, we chopped up long branches into sections, incubated them under different drying regimes. And we got these different drying regimes very simply. We don't have much money in Cardiff, so all we could do was stick polythene film on the ends and put different numbers of holes in to get different rates of drying. Very simple, but quite effective. One of the drying regimes wasn't a drying regime at all. It involved maintaining the branches at water saturation at the level in the canopy, and we just put slabs of agar on the ends to keep them moist. So this is the sort of setup we have. And let's see what we find. Now, this effectively summarises the five different drying regimes we had, and these sections were cut after a few weeks. In actual fact, we cut sections time and time again from different lengths of wood over a very long period and made isolations. But this summarises what we found. Now, the first section here was maintained under water-saturated conditions, and this represents an increasing drying regime. So, under water-saturated conditions, no fungi develop. Under this drying regime, you can quite clearly see that after a very short time, there were lots of decay columns, masses of evidence of fungal activity. And again, there's the start of fungal decay in each of these, in each of these two sections here. This one, at early stages, began to show fungal development, but the drying regime was too rapid and fungal growth stopped because rather than being too wet, as up here, we had then had the situation of being too dry. But the point is, we do get fungi out of perfectly healthy wood. But where do they come from? I haven't yet really proved to you or demonstrated to you that these fungi do come from within the wood. They could equally well come from within the bark. We can soon solve that problem. Let's debark the wood before we dry it down. And by doing this, you can discriminate between fungi which develop from bark and fungi which develop actually from within the wood cylinder. The slide two slides ago showed you a lot of decay. Let me just take you back to 3 or 4 days after the start of the optimal drying regime. And here you can see the development of very small pockets of decay. These, I believe, represent the start of development of decay from the latent propagules. Interestingly, here we have some more little pockets starting to develop, and you'll notice that they're all in the same annual ring, which is rather intriguing. What I ought to say to you, though, was that we didn't get exactly what we might have expected. When we made our isolations and did our pairings, we didn't find that we would have had great long genotypes. And to start with, the first instant, that was a bitter disappointment because, of course, this is what we'd expected. But in hindsight, knowing much more about decay in beech now, it is quite explicable. We have lots of, you'll see in attached beech branches, there are very often lots of much smaller decay columns, although they can have large ones as well. Subsequent to those experiments with beech, we've looked in much more detail at oak and ash and hazel, and in those, when you do these latent invasion experiments, you do find that the same genotype is present in lots of sections all along the branch. So I think perhaps, well, I hope that I've demonstrated to you that fungi are present within wood as latent propagules, and that water probably has a governing effect on their development. Now, this is rather an horrendous slide, which I've left up here, but it does, if I take you through it gently, it does illustrate again how important water and drying and associated oxygen, I guess, is in the development of fungal communities in wood. It seems to be very common for people nowadays to produce these three-dimensional pictures, and I'm not sure that it tells us awfully much, but I really felt that I had to do one once at least. Anyway, let's see. What does it tell us? We've got time along this axis here. We've got water content along here. And we've got, number of inocula with the various fungi on up this axis. This happens to be Hypoxylon frangiformi, which is one of the main things in the latent invasion experiment, and Coniofora puteana in this downwards direction. And you'll see effectively there are three plots on the graph. This one here represents a rapid drying regime. This one here, a less rapid drying regime. and this one was our optimal regime, which we saw earlier. Now you'll notice with the very rapid drying regime, there was, as I've already said, quick development of some fungi, but soon it tailed off because it was too dry. You can see more better development of fungi in the better drying regime. And now look at this one though here, the most optimum drying regime. This tells us something very important. The lined plot represents the presence of Hypoxylon fragiforme. This dotted plot here indicates the presence of Coniofora puteana. We got Hypoxylon fragiforme under all drying regimes, but the only time we got Coniofora puteana was under this particular drying regime. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the rate at which wood dries down probably is very important in determining which fungi develop and which fungi will subsequently colonise and decay wood. Many fungi are present as latent invaders within branches, but only some of these will develop. And one of the determinants of which ones will develop is the way in which water content, high water content, is removed. It's not only branches, incidentally, in which we find these latent propagules. We later turned our attention to twigs. As you can see from this summary slide, we looked at ash, beech and oak. The plus indicates whether there was bark present, so plus is bark present when we did these latent invasion experiments. The minus indicates the absence of bark. And you'll see that, again, several species were found. Indeed, very many more of the more species were present in twigs, but I've only indicated the most common ones. Let's just have a look at one or two important points we can get from this. Let's look at Daldinia concentrica. Now, you'll notice that Daldinia was latently present in ash, in beech, and in oak. But think where you see Daldinia normally in the field. You see it on ash trees, don't you? Well, of course, sometimes you see it on beech also, not so commonly. And oak, very few and far between. But in actual fact, when we look at ash, beech and oak twigs, when we look at the decay communities in them, we rarely, if ever, find Daldinia present. And yet it quite clearly is present as a fungal propagule. It isn't present as mycelia later on, but it was there to start with. Clearly then, in the field, conditions usually are not suitable for the development of these latent propagules of Daldinia. Present as latent propagules, rarely if ever found as mycelia in the wood. Exactly the same applies to these Xylaria species. Rarely if ever seen decay in twigs, but clearly they come out quite commonly as latent propagules. And again, this is presumably to do with the drying rate and other conditions. I suppose a question you might all be asking by now is, where do these wretched latent propagules come from? We know they're there. Perhaps you'll believe they're there now. But where do they come from? How do they gain entry to sapwood? Well, in all honesty, I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure that anyone does. But I guess we can put forward some suggestions. Perhaps they could get in as wounding, via wounds. Could they get in as a result of insect activity? We know that some decay fungi do find their way into trees following insect activity. Obviously, the Dutch elm disease fungus is a prime example. Other insects inoculate fungi when they oviposit in wood, even when they suck. So, I expect you know what I meant there. When they suck out sap. So it's another possibility. If they're in the bark already, by whatever means, just lodged in there, they could get into the sapwood if they could only get through the cambium. So if a fungus in the bark could somehow get through the cambial layer, it would then be left behind as the tree expanded and appear to be in the centre of the tree. It would never have been deposited in the centre of a branch or whatever originally. Just simply got to get through the cambium and then be left behind. It's another possibility. And associated with this is the idea that there may be some intimate relationships between living tree cells and fungi which are latently present within the trees. We already know that fungi have intimate relationships with trees. Parasitic fungi are intimately related with host cells. And of course, mycorrhizal fungi are intimately related with host root cells. And indeed, for the fungus Hypoxylon fragiforme, which we've mentioned in Beech, there is evidence that this also can be found within host cells. So there are hints that there may be some intimate relationships. Now, I can't really go much further at this stage. We don't know the answer. We'll have to ponder that and work on it probably for the next 10 years or so. It'll keep me out of mischief. One last point before I turn to a different topic, but this one again still concerns water. We spent a lot of time looking at attached beech branches, and it looks very much as if the development of communities is intimately related with water content, as I've already implied. Let's take you through some observations and another theory. So this then is supposed to represent a beech branch, and the end of this beech branch is well decayed. You can see zone lines and such like in the diagram here. We've got side branches, and these side branches, although they're not indicated, they have leaves on, they're respiring happily, and the wood is perfectly functional. So water is effectively being sucked up through these branches to the leaves. That's the function of sapwood, isn't it? Well, what happens if that branch suddenly becomes dysfunctional for whatever reason? Suddenly, there is no longer that pull, that draw on water, and the whole of this region, which is stippled in this diagram, becomes much drier. Only this part of the main branch is still full with water. So instantly we've got drying conditions. So what happens in here? Well, you know the answer to that, don't you? It's just like our latent invasion experiment in the lab and occult controlled drying regimes. Of course, the fungi which are latently present leap out as mycelia. And of course, also, the fungi which are already present in this well-decayed region can gradually extend into this aerated region. They were kept up here before because of the high water content. And so we get decay developing down here, latent propagules coming out. It's a theory, but it does fit the facts. So hopefully by this stage I have given you some inkling into the crucial role of water and the fact that much of decay in the canopy ultimately arises from the development of fungi which are latently present. I've talked about propagules, latently present propagules. I haven't suggested what they are. You might have automatically translated propagules for spores, and you could be forgiven for doing that, and indeed it may be that there are spores present. Could also be fragments of mycelium. Mycelium does break up into bits, and this could be transported in the sap stream. But an idea which Alan and I favoured from very early on is that these propagules could be yeast-like forms because yeasts are adapted to an aquatic existence. And I'm not going to say any more than that for now, but perhaps more will be revealed when I get to the end of the second part of the talk. Now, you're looking as if you may be a little bit wilted at the moment. We could perhaps break for 5 minutes to have some questions on this part before I move on to something which I hope will intrigue you.
Thank you. Have you already disproved that these propagules might come in via the roots?
No, we haven't disproved that at all. It is a possibility. Other possibilities might be, which I don't think is right, but it's a possibility, seed-borne originally.
In your experiments with the drying regimes, I'm interested in the time period that's going to elapse between you collecting your samples and you doing the experiments. Have you proved that really you might not have got colonisation in the time period by spores.
Right, you think that we might have contaminants, effectively, whilst we're whizzing back from the woods to the lab. That's a jolly good point, of course, and this was our major concern, and I guess the major concern of anybody who's ever read or refereed the papers which we published this in. We did everything in our power, firstly, to prevent contamination. If you actually look at the sections we took, if you follow from the ends, then you can see where there may have been contamination, like penicillium species, which are very common in the air all around us. But all of the information which I presented to you was taken from the centre of these sections, where there was no hint at all that there had been any colonisation from the end. Okay, that's maybe not enough evidence for you. Every single fungi, well, quite a few of the fungi which came out apparently as latent invaders, we tried to inoculate onto the sections which we cut as an extra sort of control. So we put lots of different types of spores of different species all over the ends, and none of these ever developed from the ends going in, and various other controls and that sort of line. I mean, that is the big criticism, and I think it's something you can never really get over, but I think with enough different controls and trying out enough things, I think that you can demonstrate beyond all reasonable doubt that the things are developing from within the wood. But a very important question.
Question here, please.
On that diagrammatic drawing you had just then of the trunk and reducing the area, the amount of water in the branch, you then got the decay organisms to spread. On a practical point, it seems that that could certainly happen then if you were to remove some of the leaves by branch thinning or reduction of the crown, would then encourage the spread of such things.
I guess that's absolutely true, yes. I mean, I'm sure that this is how decay develops in nature without man interfering in any way. And I'm sure that if man mimics that process, then the same sorts of things will be expected to happen, yes. Well, that's right, but you don't have to worry awfully much if it's only small things you're taking off of, because of this business of not being able to get down the stubs into the main branch. You know, you know all the theories behind these things already, and what works and what doesn't work, but that's the absolute reason why you have to be careful, yeah.
John Cromar, contractor. Would you have any comment then on any difference between removing the end of a branch vis-a-vis flow rates? Because you indicated obviously that was important.
Removing the end as compared with
removing with side branches.
The whole thing.
No, compared with removing side branches.
It depends entirely on how much of effectively the sucking capacity you're removing, doesn't it, I think?
It's just related to volume on that particular branch, volume of leaf area.
Leaf area is the crucial thing, because that is what effectively is sucking the water. And hence, usually, it is also directly related to size of the branch as well, because leaf area is related to the size.
Right. Thank you. Michael Norwich. Is the suggestion that the latent propagules are actually anaerobic?
That's a very good question also. I think that propagules can be present in anaerobic conditions without actually necessarily respiring or metabolising anaerobically. It's something we're beginning to look at as to what the propagules or what certain stages of fungal development can do under anaerobic conditions. I can't really answer that now. I'm not necessarily suggesting that they are metabolising under anaerobic conditions. They're existing under those conditions. That leads on actually to something else as well. I think we've concentrated so far today on anaerobicity, degree of oxygenation, water, and things related to that. But also, if you think about what's going on inside a branch, really, in very much of a branch, there are not awfully many living cells. There are dead cells.